Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. There's an important reason why my guest Ivy Mirapol's new film begins with a home movie. Her family's path intertwines in important ways, both personally and historically, with that of her subject.
To call Royko evil, it's true, but it doesn't explain 100 other things about him.
Every era has an opportunist, somebody who will stretch the law and ethics to make the ends justify the means.
Roy knew how to get permits taken care of, unions to do your bidding, the mafia to leave you alone.
He would do whatever he needed to win.
I found out one thing in life. Don't ever threaten unless you intend to follow through.
Bully, Coward, Victim, the story of Roy Cohn, debuts on HBO Thursday, as well as its streaming platforms. The documentary traces Cohn's combative and controversial life, whose influence can be traced all the way to the Oval Office today. Ivy Mirapol, welcome back to the Roundtable, and congrats on the film.
Thank you so much, Ian. Great to be here.
So there's been a lot of renewed attention on Roy Cohn in the past few years. Why did you want to make a movie about him?
Well, I have to say that what got me to commit to embarking on this project was the election of Donald Trump. I had thought about making a film about Cohn, on and off for years, because I find him a compelling, fascinating figure. I felt was an important figure to explore American history and also the obvious connection to my family. But I think it was because of the connection to my family that I resisted, because I'd already dealt with that in my first film, Aired on Execution, and didn't really want to revisit it. But once Donald Trump was elected, I really felt that I had to. I felt compelled to.
I think at this point we should have you explain your family's connection. Not everybody will know how Roy Cohn intersects with your grandparents.
Sure thing. Roy Cohn, as a 23-year-old prosecutor in New York City, was brought on to work as he was assistant prosecutor in my grandparents' trial, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, who were convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage and were executed in 1953 when my father was 10 years old and my uncle was 7. He made his name prosecuting them and actually was very involved in pushing for specifically the execution of my grandmother, who there was really no evidence to indicate she had been involved at all. And he knew that. He coached David Greenglass, who is my grandmother's brother. Basically, Cohn's major role in the case was to coach David Greenglass to say that his sister Ethel, my grandmother, was doing the typing of the notes that were going to be passed to the Soviet Union with alleged secrets that had been collected by the Greenglasses and my grandparents. David Greenglass later admitted that he'd never seen her doing any typing and that Roy Cohn had told him to say that.
And a lot of your movie, we should say here, your dad, Mike Mirapol, who is a commentator for WAMC News, our listeners will probably know his name, spent many years working on that case and trying to find out what the government knew and when it knew it. And he's become a champion to try to exonerate his mother, your grandmother.
Yes.
In recent years. So people may be familiar with that story. Your film is really kind of a parallel movie because it's about Roy Cohn and his influence, but it's also about your dad.
That's right. I mean, what was interesting in the process of making this film was I wasn't sure how to use my family story when we first began. I mean, I set out, as one does, making a film about a historical figure, trying to find everything out about Cohn's life that I could and finding excellent subjects to help bring his story to life and collecting archival footage and all that. Meanwhile, grappling with how to weave our family's story without repeating what I did in Aired on Execution, bringing something new to it, and also not having it dominate because, again, this was just the beginning of Cohn's career. Well, he didn't live that long, but he had a varied career and a lot of different aspects to it. So if this was just when he was 23, before he even went to Washington, D.C. to become Joe McCarthy's chief counsel. The story became, it became clear that it was almost like my father would be a counterpoint as to Cohn, and so you kind of move back and forth between their two stories and experiences, especially during the period when my father and my uncle were trying to reopen the case, when Cohn appears and becomes the public representative of the government's case. So he begins trailing them at their various press appearances, and you see in the film an incredible piece of archival material that we found where my father actually confronts him at a debate that was hosted by a French television station.
That was just an incredible part of the movie. I was going to ask you about that. What was the setting of that? They're on a television show together on the same dais, effectively.
Yes. Tele France is a French station that had aired. It was a play based on my grandparents' story. So they had just, this was a conversation that they wanted to air to play after the series, or I think it was a teleplay is exactly what it was called. So, it was a scripted dramatic version of the events around the trial. And so then they invited my father and Roy Cohn and Marshall Perlin, who was my father and uncle's lawyer, as they were trying to reopen the case. And it was just, my father had remembered doing this, but we didn't know where that footage was, and it took a lot of effort on our archival team to discover that. And my father, he talks about really relishing the opportunity to be on stage with Cohn.
Was that the only time that happened?
No, there were two other times. He was on the Barry Farber show with Cohn. We were never able to locate that footage. And then we also have a little clip in the film of my father appearing before John Conyers' committee, the House Judiciary Committee, and Cohn was there as well.
Let's talk a little bit more about Roy Cohn's origins. He was a prodigy in the law. He came from a family of Democrats in New York City, but quickly sort of radicalized in the opposite direction. And people puzzle over that in your movie. So where did his politics come from, and how did he gain so much power so soon?
I mean, what's interesting about Cohn is that he claimed to be a Democrat his whole life. I mean, he maintained that he was still a Democrat. I think he just liked to, it was like a way of irritating his opposition because he was clearly, in every other way, not a Democrat, and he was a reactionary and a big member of big proponent of the Republican Party and supporter, and helped, famously get Reagan elected. He was just a genius at collecting people and amassing that kind of power, and participating in what he learned at a very young age, what was he called the favor bank, which was you do a favor for this person and then they owe you. And he had there were many, many layers of that in his life that I think, that was early on that he was able to do that. So, for instance, he saw a great opportunity in my grandparents' trial. He made his name that way. And he then went to Washington and worked with Senator McCarthy and again becomes, this kind of rabid anti-communist figure. He used the fear of communism to amass, power by scaring people. I mean, he even said we have a great quote of him. He's being asked in an interview, what do you get when you hire Roy Cohn? And he says, I think it's to Tom Snyder. He says fear factor. And to me, he's not just talking about as your individual legal representative. It's bigger than that with him. And I think, you know, that was one way that he saw pretty quickly that he could put himself in a power position.
To a person, almost everybody in your film says at one point or another, well, he was just a terrible person. In what ways did that manifest?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, everything from not paying his bills, you know, in a way, you know, and we're not just talking, you know, big, you know, hotel expenses and things like that, but down to, you know, the local dry cleaner, right? You know, where he'd get his shirts pressed, you know, they're desperately, you know, sending him notices. You haven't paid, you know, can you please pay, Mr. Cohen, can you please pay? And you see his own handwriting on these bills saying, don't pay, just ignore. To, you know, how he would just completely eviscerate people. He would, I mean, just that we have the story of this poor gentleman, Richard DuPont, who was someone who Cohen took great advantage of and destroyed his life. There's the obvious example of my family story. That's one of the most prominent ones. I think, you know, he was ruthless. I mean, he says it himself. He would do whatever it takes to win, and that means breaking the rules. And he knew that the people he was fighting against couldn't break the rules. So he used that against them, you know, because he didn't care. And I think he was very comfortable with turning people against each other. And even using his, I mean, you know, you see him on the Larry King show saying, you know, he doesn't support gay rights, he doesn't support women's rights, all these rights bills, and, you know, he's very dismissive of them, but yet he's living, you know, fairly openly out in Provincetown and other parts of his life, hanging out Studio 54 as a gay man. So I think for a lot of people, that alone makes him a horrible person, the hypocrisy.
We're speaking with Ivy Mirapol about her new movie, Bully, Coward, Victim, The Story of Roy Cohn, which is coming to HBO this week. I don't think you ever explicitly say this in the film, but very much your movie is a media criticism, at least from where I'm sitting. Can you talk about the way that his, and you just alluded to this, his image was sort of created by the tabloid era?
One of the most revealing interviews that I did was with Cindy Adams, who you even hear me kind of react. We purposely left that in because, you know, I'm asking her, you know, how to, you know, she said, well, Roy would ask me to kill a story or ask me to put something in. And I said, well, how did he pull that off? And she just says, by asking me. You know? And I'm thinking, oh, it was much more, you know, he had to work through much more complex channels to do that. But no, he just simply asked her and she did it. He cultivated the media just I don't know anybody else who comes close to the ability he had to do that. And you see it even in Peter Manso is a good example. Peter Manso is a progressive. He's actually a red diaper baby, just like my father, even grew up in Knickerbocker Village on the Lower East Side where my father grew up, yet and believes he's a progressive person. But yet he goes and does this interview with Cohn in the early 80s that where we gather all the audio that we use in the film from, and he becomes friends with him. He starts palling around with him after that interview, even though he says he's repelled by the guy, and it goes even further. He ends up buying a house with him and Norman Mailer and sharing a property in Provincetown with him. Lois Romano talks about how he'd come to town and say, come on over to the bar, you know, by the Washington Post. I mean, he was really, really good at massaging the press that way. And I think, you know, he traded information. He was someone who, you know, they enjoyed getting to be part of it. I mean, other journalists who didn't even end up in my film who I spoke to, you know, said they would get invited to his parties. And it would feel like they were getting access, but he was really using them.
Now, speaking of which, you mentioned at the beginning of this interview that you were really inspired to make it once Donald Trump took office. Take us through the Cohn-Trump relationship. How did it start, and how did Cohn influence Trump?
Sure. So from the what they met in at a club called it's kind of funny to say, it's called Le Club, and this was in the early 70s, and it was quite the hot spot in New York City on the Upper East Side, and from what I understand, Trump was desperate to get into this club. Like, I think he even wrote about it, he definitely wrote about it in one of his books. I can't remember which one, but they, you know, that was where all the gorgeous women were, and he wanted to get into this club. And Le Club was one of Cohn's haunts. They met there. Trump approached him. He'd supposedly heard that Cohn was really tough, and he liked the way that he, you know, fought back and didn't take anything from the other side and never gave up. And he said, "I'd like you to work I'd like to bring you on work with my family, with my father." With the real estate company that Trump's father owned. And they were involved in a discrimination case, housing discrimination case. The Trump family business was being investigated, and Cohn took on that case. And Cohn fought back. He used his, you know, the classic Cohn tactics of attacking the government, and we have in the film, Peter Manto describes this very thing, and where Cohn, you know, called them Nazis and called them the Ku Klux Klan. You know, it's that idea of, like, turning it around, you know, turning it back on and blasting them with you know, worse accusations to inoculate themselves. And so, anyway, that was the beginning of this union that became so much more than him, than Cohn just being Trump's attorney. They became close friends. They, at certain periods of their friendship and relationship, I've been told they talked on the phone like 5 times a day. They socialized together. They went out together. But then what happened is that Cohn, I think, really started to see that he could shape Trump's future and shape Trump's position, and that would be advantageous, of course, to Cohn. So he introduced Trump to all of his Washington connections, and as Cohn became the biggest fundraiser and organizer in New York for the Reagan campaign, he simultaneously brought Trump into that circle. And what we discovered in making the film through the excellent journalist Lois Romano from the Washington Post is that Cohn really started to plant the idea in Trump's head and connect him to all the right people to get there, that Trump could be a major figure on the national stage himself. So he starts thinking he could be the nuclear arms negotiator. And now this is during the Cold War, and we are... You know, there's Trump, who hasn't shown any sign of expertise or even interest in any kind of major policy issues important during that time. But yet there's Cohn going on TV and setting up an interview. He set it up himself because he was friendly with Lois Romano. He said, "You need to interview this guy, Donald Trump, from New York." And that began, and I feel like we really pinpointed almost the moment where Trump started thinking, "Hey, I could do this." And it was Cohn who got that started.
And in a bit of foreshadowing, he says, "I could know everything there is to know about this arms negotiation in an hour."
Oh,
something
it's
like
just
that.
An unbelievable. Yeah, the quote, yeah, he says, Trump says, yeah, to Lois Romano as she's interviewing him, I could learn everything I need to know about nuclear missiles in an hour and a half." We recognize that person.
And he also gets to know people like Roger Stone and Paul Manafort, who would play such an outsized role down the line.
That's right. I mean, they are all brought together, and Cohn is the linchpin.
I don't want to give away where the title of your movie comes from, because it's an interesting aspect of the story, but... He had a very sad ending. Can you talk about the last few years of Roy Cohn's life?
Sure. And what makes it even more poignant is that he was really at the top of his game, and he was in the position that he'd always wanted to be, kind of back in Washington after being run out of town after the Army-McCarthy hearings, which, you know, he really always wanted to be a big player in Washington. And then he was run out, spent all that time in New York, but he was back in the fold with the Reagan White House. And then he gets sick, and he says he has liver cancer. As people are noticing, he's not looking well. He's disappearing at times for treatments, and he goes on television looking just awful and frail, and he's confronted directly by, you know, people like Mike Wallace saying, you know, do you have AIDS? Because he did have AIDS, and he never admitted it, despite traveling to the National Institutes of Health in Washington, D.C., where he was actually given access to early trials of AZT secretly. He even told his own cousin, who we have in the film telling us this, that he was going there for a new treatment for liver cancer, and which the NIH wasn't even working on. It was AZT, and we know this now. This is something Tony Kushner explores in Angels in America as well. Of course, the AZT did not work, and he died in 1986. And he died never admitting that he had AIDS. And he also died being somewhat abandoned by many of the kind of biggest names in his circle. And some of the poignant audio that we have towards the end of the film, you know, you hear a very diminished Cohn, you know, contemplating his own memorial service, and you know, wondering who's going to be there, and if anyone's even going to say that he was a good guy, which I found surprising.
Last thing, I mean, I know your film has a point of view, but he's not around to defend himself, of course. And given your family history, which is so vital to this story, I imagine someone could say, oh, well, this is just kind of sour grapes is not the right term. But do you know what I'm saying?
That I know exactly what you're saying, because I was aware of this the whole time that it could easily look like this is the Rosenberg revenge film.
Much right? Better term.
That's what. And I did not want I actively worked against that. I mean, I didn't want it to be written off as that. And that's not really what it is. If I had wanted to make a Rosenberg revenge film, I probably would have made this film years ago. But because it was really the decision to make the film was motivated by my belief that that we need to know more about our history. We need to know more about how the Cohn tactics and ethos that informs where we are now. I mean, I felt it was really important. It's another way of exposing, you know, how people like Cohn and Trump, you know, stoke the fear of whether it's communists, immigrants, Black Lives Matter protesters who are being called thugs, you know, after 9/11, Islamic terrorists. All of that is used to divide us, and I just felt like it was an important part of history, Cohn's life, and how he wielded power was an important thing for all of us to understand now. And so it's beyond what happened to my grandparents. It's bigger than that.
Ivy Mirapol is the filmmaker of Bully, Coward, Victim, The Story of Roy Cohn, which comes to HBO this week. Ivy, thanks so much for doing our show. Congrats on the film, and all best to your dad.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you.
And you're listening to WAMC.